You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts.
My guest is Saeed Jones, author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise, which was a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award, one of NPR's best books of 2014, and the winner of the 2015 Penn Literary Award for Poetry. Jones is also the literary editor for BuzzFeed. He grew up in Texas, and his poetry explores themes of race, sexuality, power, violence, mythology, and intimacy. Prelude to Bruise is separated into six sections, where much of the poetry contains a narrative arc telling the story of Boy, a Black homosexual living in the South who lost his mother and is at odds with his homophobic father. We began the interview discussing how Jones got into writing.
I started writing poetry, I think, the way most people do, which is I was a teenager with a lot of feelings. And I just, you know, I kept a notebook, and I started really writing when I was in like 12 or 13. And I just like kind of kept a notebook to myself. And it wasn't always necessarily poems. Sometimes it would be more like dramatic monologues. I was always really interested in persona. I liked writing in the voices of figures, almost always women, actually, from Greek mythology. And I just kept with it, but it was always very private. I didn't share my work very often, and it kind of just was something that I did on my own. And then in college, I went to a few poetry slams and would compete. And so I kind of had to drag out the poems again. And I was like, okay, but not especially great. So I started taking writing workshops at the college I was studying at, Western Kentucky University. And the workshop experience really opened me up. I didn't know that it was like actually possible for people to seriously focus on poetry. I grew up in a very working class family. And so, you know, your job was about income. It was about putting, you know, food on the table and keeping a roof over your head. And so the idea of like really intensely focusing on poetry, which is an intense focus on art, you know, until then seemed very unrealistic. But all of a sudden I was in, you know, in a workshop with a wonderful professor, Tom Hundley, and then, you know, I just kind of stuck with it. I ended up changing my major, and, you know, then he started telling me about graduate programs. It was just like this whole world opened up to me. And I was fortunate enough, I think, that along the way, mentors started kind of coming into my life and basically just telling me to keep going, because I don't think I would have thought to keep walking. I don't think I realized I was on a path until maybe I was in graduate school. So, you know, kind of it took a lot of help, a lot of support.
So I want to talk about your work, Prelude to Bruise, before we talk about specific poems. But I wrote down just a list of things that I felt kept recurring through these poems, whether they were an image or an idea. Tongues, fathers with difficult relationships with their sons, locked rooms, dresses, water, fields, gay identity, but also gay secrecy, fire, flames, and burning, a boy who seemed to come out early, and violence. So that was a list of things I noticed, and I'm just wondering if you want to, I know it's a long list, but if you want to comment on any of that, or if there's stuff I missed, or just talk about the nature of some of those things.
Prelude to Bruise is a very elemental book, and so fire and water and the natural environment are pretty important symbols, in part because I felt, you know, since I was grounding this narrative in in the American South. And in that particular cultural landscape, it was clear that the Bible and its stories and images would be an important text for the voices. It would be something that, you know, would influence the kind of images that they would call to mind. And so you know, Sodom and Gomorrah is referenced, or Isaac and Abraham. And obviously there's a lot of fire and water, both as an image of purity, of fluidity, of gender fluidity, of motherhood. In Toni Morrison's Noble Address, at one point she mentions what it is to live at the edge of towns that cannot bear your company. And I'd been working on the book or the poems in the book for about 2 or 3 years because I really just focused on just writing poems more so than trying to write a book initially. But as a narrative started kind of to come into focus, I thought about that phrase, at the edge of the town. And I had this image of a father and his son who live in, you know, a cabin just at the edge of town, which for me was both kind of where the intersection of magical realism happens, which happens throughout the book, where, you know, it's 1 foot on the ground and 1 foot, you know, in kind of the air of possibility. And I had this idea that the mother was gone, either she had run away or she had passed away, but it was a very raw grief for the father and son. And so as the boy begins to, you know, go through the house and find, you know, his mother's beautiful evening gowns that she left behind, and he tries them on, part because he's exploring his own sexuality and identity, and partially because he misses his mother, and this is a way of engaging his grief. I figured that it would trigger his father's own grief. And in my experience, grief often kind of lights up a lot of different emotions depending on someone's life. And so in the case of this narrative, you know, his rage and his fear comes out. And so that kind of created a narrative, a narrative engine, if you will, that really kind of drove the rest of the experience of working on the book. And so, you know, those images that you were kind of alluding to, the fire, the water, fathers and difficult sons, and sexuality and secrecy or forced secrecy, all kind of come out of that idea.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Saeed Jones, author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise.
When you blend the emotional truths of your life with this fictional narrative to create your poetry, what is that process like? Is that a conscious process? You were saying that this book took you 2 years, but I think for someone who doesn't know poetry and they just look at a page and it has like 10 lines and they're like, what?
So the book actually took 5 to 6 years. It was just that it took 2 years before Boy even showed up in the way that the narrative did, because I started out just writing, you know, one poem at a time, and then it kind of started to coalesce. I think when I'm writing a poem, I'm very, very focused on the line itself. And so for me, it's all about writing one line at a time. And I don't want to move on to even the next line or stanza until I feel like I've gotten to where I need to be. So for me, it's a very almost kind of microscopic writing process that I really enjoy. I know that might sound a bit painstaking, but for me, that's the pleasure that I get to think about language and image, you know, much more intensely than we would, you know, in regular conversation or storytelling. But I think what happens is that anything you write, even if you're writing in a very focused microscopic level, like I was describing, all of your work has to pass through the lens of your life. And you know, and so, you know, all of your obsessions and your preoccupations, whatever you're reading, you know, if you've gone to the museum recently, you know, the weather, the music, all of these things, I think, kind of trickle in. And so in many ways, I feel that I've been writing this book my entire life. When I look at it, I see, you know, the fruition of different memories and experiences, of relationships, of artistic appreciation, that then begin to kind of guide the emotions that I was examining while I worked on the book. So for me, it's once I kind of accepted the freedom of, I don't need to worry about the facts in this poem, as long as I can pursue the truth, then I found that things kind of clicked into place over time. But it took a while to get to the point to feel comfortable just doing that.
There's a line in your poem, Last Call, that says, I've got more hunger than my body can hold. And I'm wondering if you walk around feeling like that.
I think we all do. I think, you know, for me, that's a very, it strikes me as a very American feeling, right? That, you know, the more hunger, more ambition. I want more than the life I've been given seems to have room for. I think that's a really, it's not necessarily a great idea, but I think it's an influential idea in our culture. And so for me, I do think about that. I think we all often feel we want or aspire to more, that perhaps, you know, the metaphorical body that we're living within, you know, we're held back, you know, either because of oppression or circumstances or the consequences of other decisions we've made ourselves, you know. And so throughout the book, I mean, that kind of in some ways sums up Boy, right? He's this very, he has an ambitious drive to live. And actually what he wants is very simple. He wants to live as who he is, and he wants to be able to love freely. So in some ways, that is actually incredibly humble. But because of the cultural context he exists in, because he, you know, he's young, he's isolated, friendship and mentorship is not a part of his life, because of homophobia and racism, his very simple aspiration is perhaps more than his body can hold. It's dangerous. And so we see it actually becomes a matter of peril over the course of the book.
Can we talk about the first poem, Anthracite?
Of course. Of course.
Can you read it?
Sure. And I'll say that anthracite is a type of coal. Anthracite. A voice mistook for stone, jagged black fist thrown miles through space through doors of dark matter. Heard you crack open the field's skull where you landed. Halo of smoke ruined the sky, and you were a body now, naked and bruised in the cratered cotton. Could have been a meteorite except for those strip-mined eyes, each a point of fossilized night. Bringing water and a blanket, I asked, which of your lives is this, third or fifth? Your answer, blues. A breeze to soak my clothes in tears. With my palm pressed to your lips, hush. When they hear you, they will want you. Beware of how they want you. In this town, everything born black also burns.
So for me, as the opening of this book, I read it many times and I wrote down, you know, at first it sort of reminded me of God coming down to earth and becoming incarnate. It had undertones for me of slavery, of a boy's birth, the ruin of being an incarnate person, sex and pain. And that's sort of what I read into it. But can you tell me more about your intention and what you were thinking?
Absolutely. So ironic, you know, of course, just after I said about grounding the book's opening in narrative, it actually opens with a lyric poem. But I chose Anthracite as the book's frontis, as the actual prelude to the collection itself, because it appears actually right before the first section, because it introduces a lot of important images, all of which you so expertly identified, and kind of set an important tone, which is this sense of peril. We have this figure in which kind of in the poem, to me, it's a bit of like this kind of mythic, you know, origin story, if you will. And you have this man who arrives and because of the allusion to the cotton field, you know, lands in the southern terrain, in my mind, and in the midst of slavery, or perhaps more accurately, the legacy of slavery, and is already in danger, right? We have this figure who comes to help him and with water and a blanket, and is kind of already warning him that because you are who you are, you're already in dangerous in danger. And in fact, the more people will learn about you, perhaps the more in danger you are. And so for me, I mean, that's haunting and disturbing. And I think, you know, when I was growing up, something that I really had to grapple with was my family members trying to warn me and protect me from racism. And so often I would, you know, I wouldn't get, you know, a coda that was quite so abstract, but, you know, family members would always say, like, be careful, and you shouldn't do this, and you have to think about this. And, you know, if you ever see a police officer, if ever, you know, and I was always, I've always been kind of stubbornly optimistic. And so when I was younger, I just really couldn't understand. I thought everyone was just being paranoid. I thought my, you know, especially, you know, my grandmother and my mother, I thought they were just being paranoid in their concern for me. But as I grew up, and, you know, began to step out into the world more myself, I developed an understanding of where they were coming from, that things were changing, and things are still changing. But obviously, racism, homophobia, hate, sadly, are still realities for far too many of us. And so that was the peril my family was trying to help me understand. And so, you know, because this is a book where we see young people often, and in this case, boys, kind of really boldly just running out into the world, I thought it was important to open with that understanding.
In these poems, there's also a lot of fear and pain and real true threats to boys' sexuality. And I know you experienced a horrific incident where you were beat up, nearly killed for being gay. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. It's actually the subject of the next book I'm working on, which will be a memoir. I've been working on it for a couple of years, and as things, as I have more time to write, hopefully in the next few months, I'll be diving into it again. But in college, I went to a New Year's Eve party and met a guy and went home with him. And we started making love, and he had what I can only describe as an actual crisis of masculinity, and he tried to kill me. He panicked, and I fortunately was able to get away, you know, mostly unharmed, and I've spent the years since that incident thinking about the ways in which our understanding of what it means to be a man is tied up with violence, with racism and homophobia, is sexism, because really at its root, that's what homophobia it is, right? It's sexism. So, and that's, I feel, an important idea. And so, you know, obviously those themes appear throughout the book in the sense of you see boy trying to figure out his life, and he's obviously doing it alongside the other men in his life, often with clashes and sparks and brutal consequences. But I'm working on a book in which I'm able to focus actually more directly on my life and connect different themes, because I think the idea of American masculinity is very complicated and really important for us to engage, because obviously, whether we like it or not, we are all engaging the idea of American manhood in various ways.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Saeed Jones, author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise.
Well, can you read a passage from a writer that influenced you?
Of course, of course. So Toni Morrison is a writer whose work changed my life, saved my life, has reintroduced me to my life many times. My mom had several of her books in the house, and I started reading Toni Morrison's work when I was 12 or 13. and I should say well before I actually understood much of it. But as a result, she's a writer who I've grown up with. And so I wanted to read this one part of her Nobel address. "You old woman, blessed with blindness, can speak the language that tells us what only language can, how to see without pictures. Language alone protects us from the scariness of things with no names. Language alone is meditation. Tell us what it is to be a woman so that we may know what it is to be a man. What moves at the margin? What it is to have no home in this place, to be set adrift from the one you knew. What it is to live at the edge of towns that cannot bear your company." And she goes on from there. But I just found that moment in her address so evocative. And this, you know, and obviously, you know, if you want to go to the legacy of slavery, in which, you know, millions of people were set adrift from the home they knew, or if you want to, you know, take it to the individual experience of perhaps feeling that we haven't quite found our personal home in this world.
Can you read something that you wrote? It could be something that you found really difficult, that went through many drafts, or just something you succeeded at.
That is a great question. Yes, I'll read one of the poems I wrote about my mother after her passing. It's a very lyric poem, in part because I think for a time, grief kind of took away a sense of narrative, which is to say the trust of the beginning, middle, and end. Grief just kind of eschews our relationship to past, present, and future, and everything kind of is blurred. And so this is a poem about the attempt to grapple with that and how difficult it is. Mercy. Her ghost slips into the room wearing nothing but the memory of a song. Then as a note lost in a little girl's throat, mercy. If fog had a sound, if the moon decided to hold its breath, if she ever heard the way I cry out in my sleep, mercy. She knows I'm not well, sees the dark circling my eyes, one more inheritance, mercy. Her stare traces me, and a hand reaches out, but, Mama, I don't know the words.
Was that something that had to go through a lot to get there?
Yes, it was a poem that once I sat down to write it, once I decided to actually write exactly about how I felt. I won't say easy, but it was, you know, it began to flow. But it took a very long time to feel comfortable directly addressing my mother, the memory of my mother, and my grief. Because, as I've mentioned, you know, for me, blurring my own life and myth and fiction is how I prefer to write. It's also, I think, in some ways, it gives me a shield, a kind of comfort. And grief kind of strips away all of those veils. And I really wanted to, as best I could, write a poem to speak to that moment in my life, which was really the unspeakable. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. And so I remember thinking of the phrase, if fog had a sound. And that to me just really evoked what grief felt like at the time. So for me, the hardest part was making it to the page, because it meant kind of staring down an incredible foe. Grief really knocked me flat.
Where do you write?
It changes depending on the circumstances of my life. I prefer to write at home at my desk. I prefer for it to be quiet. You know, I like to light some candles. I like to be near a window. But that is a luxury. often I'm writing, you know, in the office late in the evening. Sometimes I'll just stay until everyone else has gone home and I'm just at my desk. And I take a lot of notes, and the act of taking notes is something I'm just doing kind of constantly about my day and whenever I get a chance to jot something down. But I feel I'm at my best if it's very, very quiet, perhaps early in the morning, and I've woken up to write, and that's all I need to do for a couple of hours. That's what I prefer to write.
And what do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
That's a good question. I love to travel because I'm an editor full time. You know, writing and language is just kind of it's inseparable from my life in some ways. And so I think the only way I'm able to really fully step away from writing and thinking about writing is travel, either because I'm on an airplane and I don't have access to the internet, or I turn my phone off, or because, you know, I like to go to some remote location and really just kind of take a break from the world, because I think that isolation is actually really great for writing, but you need to be away. You need to have time to just kind of sit with yourself, which is difficult to do, I think, in 21st century life.
And who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Not many people. That's actually something that's really difficult for me. I'm a perfectionist and panic at the thought of showing my work to people before I feel like it's good enough. But I do have some close friends who have become, you know, really great readers of my work. And I think I feel as safe with them as they feel as comfortable, you know, giving me honest feedback. Because, you know, often what writers need is someone to just tell them to keep going. Sometimes that's the best advice. But if you're really lucky, you can find, you know, a few friends who can also tell you, you know, the truth and some wise but tough advice that's necessary too.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Oh God, it's never personal. That's something I always try to remember. You know, oh my goodness, you know, getting work published in literary journals is a real lesson in rejection. Something that perhaps poets have to deal with more than prose writers, because you know we're submitting work more frequently, I think. And often, I think when you are rejected, especially from, you know, a really fancy literary journal or something you really want, or some, you know, some publisher, in some ways, I think it's a way of the world protecting you, or that's how I try to think of it. You know, often your work isn't ready when you think it's ready. And really the worst thing for a writer is for work that is not ready to be published, to be out in the world, because you can't take it back.
And what is your favorite word?
I find I use the word listen. In conversation very much, as a bit of a punctuation mark. So I use listen as like a comma. So when someone's saying something really interesting, or I agree with them and I'm trying to like emphasize, just like listen, and then I keep going. But of course, I also like, you know, the values of emphasizing the word listen. And I personally am someone who's always running around, often distracted, always worried about what's next, and thinking too far ahead. And for me, when I think about the word listen, it also requires me to slow down and stop for a moment and really root myself in the moment, which is something I absolutely need to do more.
You've been listening to First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. My guest was Saeed Jones, author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest was Saeed Jones, author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing, and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.